I hope everyone has been enjoying themselves. I think Boston is truly beautiful, even in the rain. I commend those of you who participated in the run this morning. That was a new thing for the CSTE annual conference, and I know I was down in the lobby when the runners were coming in, and it was really exciting to see that. I think some of us has also had some new experiences in addition to the run. So I'm from Florida, and last night there were a number of folks, including myself, who were buying sweatshirts. So Al, we are going to request a little bit warmer weather for the future. I also think that I have had, during this conference, the good fortune to have some really wonderful and great intellectual conversations and connecting with friends, and I hope that all of you will find time for those kinds of conversations during the rest of the time that we have together. I had the great fortune this morning of introducing two amazing women. First is Dr. Nancy Kerger, who is a professor of social epidemiology at the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences at the Harvard T. Chan School of Public Health and director of interdisciplinary concentration on women, gender, and health. She is an internationally recognized social epidemiologist with a background in biochemistry, philosophy of science, and history of public health. She has years of activism involving social justice, science, and health. Her work addresses conceptual frameworks to understand, analyze, and improve people's health, including the eco-social theory of disease distribution. The eco-social theory was first proposed by name in 1994 by Dr. Kerger. The theory assumes that distributions of diseases are determined at multiple levels and that analyses must incorporate historical, political, economic, temporal, and spatial analyses. She is an ISI, highly cited scientist, which is a group of scientists consuming or compromising less than 0.5% of all published researchers. She received the Wade Hampton Frost Award from the Epidemiology Section of the American Public Health Association and has been awarded the American Cancer Society Clinical Research Partnership. She has some wonderful books that she has authored, edited, and co-edited. My favorite is The Epidemiology and Public and People's Health, Theory and Context, an interesting read about why epidemiologic theory matters. She has a number of other books, too, including Embodying Inequality, Epidemiologic Perspectives, HIV/AIDS, The Politics of Survival, and Women's Health, Politics, and Power, Essays on Sex, Gender, Medicine, and Public Health. In 1994, she co-founded and still chairs the Spirit of the 1848 Caucus of the American Public Health Association, which is concerned with the links between social justice and public health. Please welcome Dr. Nancy Kerger. I think you pose some very tough questions for us in public health. I wonder if we're all a little intimidated by some of those. But I really appreciate the challenges that you have posed for us because I do think that it represents opportunities for us to think in broader contexts than sometimes we do. I guess my question would be if you have thoughts, given the analyses that you've done in different areas on how some of those have been used already at this point in time to impact positive change.
So I can start with a very local example, which is, again, here in Boston, we've helped out colleagues at Boston Medical Center who wanted to get a handle on what was going on with their patients who were diabetic but had uncontrolled diabetes. This is a study led by our colleague, Dr. Karen Lasser. And what happened in that study is we were able to show the census tracts in which the people who were diabetic, who had uncontrolled diabetes, were concentrated. We also then mapped, for example, the issues around bus routes. And what the results clearly showed is that they were people who lived in areas with lousy bus transportation, and parking at the hospital where they're supposed to go to is completely, for anybody that lives in Boston, if you know where Boston Medical Center is, you know that parking is not really a friendly option. So what this began to suggest was actually questions about, one, having a van, two, trying to figure out whether transportation issues are in part of the problem, and they had never thought about their patients before in spatial terms and linking the spatial and social economic conditions. So that's one very local example, and that's moving forward to a bigger grant to start to figure out what could be better practices, and puts the hospital now in a position of thinking in population health terms as well as actually about individual patients. So that's one quick example. The second example that I showed was that the work that we did in Boston was very key for that campaign around saying neighborhoods matter and beginning to have an emphasis on how do you change neighborhood conditions in physical and social and economic terms in order to help improve health of residents, not only having the intervention that a health department does be focused on changing individual behaviors, but understanding that individual behaviors are constrained by context, which gets back to the analysis of structural health. More broadly, then, the last example is that by the SEER registries, the cancer registries, incorporating our approach to looking at economic variation, we can begin to have not only racialized data on cancer rates, but include race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic position, therefore understanding the combination of both and not having the persistent racialized discourse in the U.S., which is so heavily influenced by old-fashioned, inaccurate ideas about innate racial difference, and actually, again, put it in social context as linked to economic context and also experiences of discrimination.
So I do see that we have one question, but I also want to give time to our next speaker. So what I would like to do is go ahead and move on, and then hopefully we'll have some time at the end. I absolutely want to ensure that you have time. Our next speaker is someone who I have always wanted to meet and always wanted to introduce. So I was very pleased to meet her this morning. Rear Admiral Anne Schuchat, her quote, "Public service is a privilege. For me, it has also been a joy," I think truly embodies her. When I was meeting her this morning, she, you know, made the comment very cheerfully that she loved her job, and I think that we in public health see that at the jurisdiction level on a daily basis. She has an uncanny ability, I think, of remaining calm under pressure, even when being questioned by senators. I always wonder how she does it. Maybe it's a hidden tack in her shoe. Dr. Anne Schuchat serves as the director of the National Center for Immunizations and Respiratory Diseases at CDC. Her public health career roots, like many in this room, began as an EIS officer in 1988. Her work has primarily focused on immunization, respiratory, and other infectious diseases. Prior to her current appointment, she served as the director for the CDC's National Immunization Program, acting director for the National Center for Infectious Diseases, as well as chief for the respiratory disease branch for the National Center for Infectious Diseases. She was the initial medical director for the ABCs program, or the Active Bacterial Core Surveillance Program, within the Emerging Infections Program Network. She was named an Assistant Surgeon General of the United States Public Health Service in 2006. She also served as the CDC's interim director, or deputy director for science. You will see her on the front lines of disease emergency response. For many of us, myself included, if I'm listening to her on a conference call, it also means I'm really busy. She has worked globally in West Africa on meningitis vaccine studies, in South Africa on surveillance and prevention projects, and in China on the SARS emergency response. During the 2001 anthrax attacks, she served as the head of the CDC's anthrax emerging response team. Her contributions have been widely recognized. She received the U.S. Public Health Service Mentorist Service Award, the Public Health Service Physician Research of the Year, and she was elected to the Institute of Medicine and received the American Public Health Association's Maternal and Child Health Young Investigator Award. She's also on Wikipedia. Please welcome Dr. Ann Schuchat.
Thank you for that incredible introduction. And for those of you in the back, there are lots of seats in the front, and it's okay if you walk out in the middle of this. It is such a pleasure to be back at CSTE. I really want to thank Joe and Laureen for inviting me to speak. I also want to thank Laureen for uninviting me to speak last year, because I think this year's there's a lot more food for thought talking this year. And I was thrilled to be in this session about looking backward, realizing that I'm one of the backward-looking people in the room. I wanted to start with a quote from Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, who said, "Life has to be lived forwards, but can only be understood backwards." So what I want to do this morning is look backwards. 5 years ago, I got to speak at the CSTE meeting in Portland. And I want to reflect on where we were then and where we are now. So 5 years ago, we had just come through the first pandemic of the 21st century. And you'll remember that this pandemic of H1N1 influenza was detected in arguably the most prepared, wealthiest country in the world. It was still difficult for us to deal with that. Last year, the Ebola epidemic emerged in one of the regions of the world least prepared to deal with this, with the least resources and one of the most fragile health systems, just coming out of civil war and other difficulties. And that epidemic has so far led to a human toll that is 10 times greater than all of the Ebola cases and outbreaks we've ever had in human history. Even here in the United States, the Ebola situation was challenging. Preparedness is a continuum, and every nation can improve. Until every nation can prevent, detect, and respond effectively, everyone is at risk. I think that it's clear this last year that strengthening capacity at the source of these outbreaks is absolutely essential. And I'm very excited that there are now emergency resources, large-scale resources, focused on implementing the global health security agenda and completing the Ebola response to really help countries that are hardest hit with health systems challenges and these epidemics improve their capacity to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious threats. 5 years ago, Borders had over 500 superstores. Since that time, they've filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Public health has had its own drama at our borders in the past few years. 5 years ago, public health was explaining why closing the border with Mexico was not likely to impact the H1N1 epidemic. Since then, we've had importations of infectious agents in many means. Just about a year ago, the first importation of the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS virus, occurred when a healthcare worker returned from Saudi Arabia, bringing the virus into a community hospital in Indiana. That hospital, that local health department and state health department, as well as similar entities in Florida, responded quickly to those importations of MERS virus, and these episodes did not result in spread here in the U.S. We stepped up awareness among travelers at airports and other means, and we continue to monitor this situation globally. Land borders were also the focus last year when thousands of unaccompanied children crossed the border into the United States, fleeing difficult situations in Central America. Overcrowding in shelters led to outbreaks of respiratory infections. But again, public health at the front line responded with emergency vaccination, with influenza and pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. And this year, the expectation is that that kind of overcrowding will not be a problem. While most of public health's attention has been at ports of entry, some vectors are taking a more scenic route into the country. 5 years ago, as a country, as a public health community, we had just carried out the largest emergency immunization effort in our nation's history. More than 80 million Americans were vaccinated with the H1N1 monovalent influenza vaccine, on top of over 100 million seasonal flu immunizations given that year. It was difficult. Some of you will remember that we had challenges with rumors, with supply and demand mismatches, with issues of equity of who was getting vaccine first. And the pandemic peaked before large numbers of doses were available. More recently, we were able to fast-track availability of investigational meningococcal B vaccine so that even before the vaccines were licensed here in the U.S., universities and health departments were able to emergently vaccinate colleges where outbreaks of this bacteria were occurring. And since that time, the FDA has licensed two meningococcal B vaccines through an accelerated approval pathway. We've done even better at fast-tracking use of investigational vaccines in the West Africa situation. The horrors of the Ebola epidemic led researchers and industry and government to try to move vaccines from animal studies very rapidly into human studies, with phase one studies initiated last fall and three phase three trials initiated early this year. This afternoon at the risk communications session, I'll be talking about the CDC's collaborative study in Sierra Leone, where we're looking at an investigational Ebola vaccine for healthcare workers. I think the very best example of vaccination progress in the past 5 years is this one. 5 years ago, in Burkina Faso, the first campaign for a meningococcal A conjugate vaccine, Menafrivac, began. This vaccine was developed by public-private partnership through funding from the Gates Foundation and has now reached over 200 million Africans and has eliminated epidemics of meningococcal A disease in the continent. We are really, really encouraged by this progress, and really it's the new normal for vaccine development. 5 years ago, the severe respiratory threat world got good news when the second-generation pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, PCV13, was licensed for children. This vaccine addressed the remaining burden of severe disease in kids and also addressed the multi-drug-resistant 19A strain that had emerged as problematic after the first-generation vaccines were used. Well, conjugate vaccines against pneumococcus don't just protect the person who gets them. They also reduce spread from vaccinated to others. And in a really exciting advance, the first 3 years of use of this vaccine has already averted 30,000 cases of serious disease and about 3,000 deaths, most of those deaths in adults who weren't directly vaccinated but benefited from children being vaccinated. So this was really good news for severe respiratory threats. But unfortunately, since 5 years ago, we've had a real alphabet soup of new emerging severe respiratory infectious agents. Well, we'll see what this one is. I was going to tell you that MERS has now affected over 1,200 people around the world. And of course, you've been following the recent story in Korea with about 150 or more people affected with the Middle East respiratory virus, a real reminder of how important infection control is. One traveler came back to Korea with that virus, but it was able to spread through challenges in the hospital environment, a reminder for all of us to beef up our infection control. We were barely out of the woods last spring with MERS in Florida and Indiana when we saw a summer peak in severe respiratory infections in children. First recognized in Kansas City and Chicago, the virus spread nationwide. Severe respiratory illness in children prompted specimens to be collected and tested at state or local health departments. And those specimens that were suspected to be an enterovirus or rhinovirus were forwarded on for special testing at CDC. Of over 1,500 specimens tested, 45% were the enterovirus D68, a virus that was first seen in 1962, but was not a very common pathogen. 30% of the specimens had another virus, but no one virus accounted for more than 4% of cases. So this really was a nationwide outbreak of enterovirus D68 coming seemingly out of nowhere. At this point, the CDC has developed a specific real-time PCR test, and the FDA has authorized emergency use of that assay, so we'll be able to supply public health departments with that specific test in time for this summer to see whether we suffer from this outbreak again. It's really new territory in the enterovirus world. And the enterovirus season was just winding down when flu season began. In case you weren't aware, this past winter was one of the worst influenza seasons we've had since we've been tracking hospitalizations carefully. The 2014-15 season was characterized by H3N2 strains, which are typically more severe and harder hit for the elderly in particular. But last year was also complicated by the strains having drifted away from the vaccine that we were using. So vaccine effectiveness was quite low, and in fact, in the elderly, there probably wasn't efficacy. The only silver lining in this past year's flu season was that we had recently updated vaccine recommendations for people over 65 to include direct vaccination with a 13-valent pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. Because pneumococcal pneumonia is a common complication of flu, this vaccine is truly life-saving, particularly in bad flu years. We hope that more seniors will take advantage of the vaccine. 5 years ago, the global polio eradication program had stalled. We were dealing with large outbreaks in the Congo and Tajikistan. One very respected authority criticized the program that the eradication had become more of a lifestyle than a mission. And the program really took that critique to heart and stepped up. Led by the government and people of India, we saw an extraordinary accomplishment. India has now been certified polio-free after 3 years without the virus. Remaining disease had focused in Nigeria, and we now have gone since last August, since there's been a wild poliovirus case in all of Africa. This is another extraordinary moment, but one that we can't take lightly. The program's really intensifying efforts in Africa to sustain the progress that's been made and turning enormous attention to Pakistan and Afghanistan, where we have never interrupted transmission. Now, for most Americans, polio seems very long gone, very far away, these problems in other parts of the world. But last year, we got our own polio-like scare. Clinicians in Colorado noticed acute flaccid myelitis or limb weakness, a polio-like syndrome affecting children in that state. And soon, we had reports from all around the country. So far, more than 100 cases of acute flaccid myelitis have been reported in the U.S. since last August. We don't know the etiology of this. The temporal association with the enterovirus D68 outbreak is intriguing, but thus far etiologic studies have not been conclusive. We don't know if we're going to see more of this year, but many of you know there's a CSTE resolution about really standardizing the case definition and how surveillance for this condition might work so that we really do understand baseline and whether we're having increasing problems with this. 5 years ago, highly pathogenic avian influenza strains were affecting migratory birds and domestic or commercial poultry in Asia. They were also affecting, causing outbreaks in birds in parts of Africa and Europe. But this was another one of those things that was far away and seemed very remote from our own experience. But as many of you know, since December, we've been dealing with our own H5 problems in North America. More than 20 states now have found the virus in migratory birds or in commercial birds. And in fact, more than 40 million chicken or turkeys have been killed in the course of responding to this. We know that the agricultural authorities are in the lead, but the link with human health remains important. As many workers are helping with the culling, we need to make sure that respiratory illness that develops in workers exposed to the H5 strains are quickly evaluated. There haven't been any human cases of H5 in the United States, but we need to keep our eye out. Now, this is a serious issue, and I don't mean to make light of it at all. But I was thinking, about 5 years ago, around my family's Thanksgiving table, the question was, had any of us gotten the H1N1 vaccine yet? I think this year, the question might be, what's for dinner? 5 years ago, we were watching an emerging measles epidemic in France. About 15,000 measles cases occurred during that two-year period. Factors that contributed to measles getting so out of control were the absence of immunization requirements for school entry and complacency about the virus and the need for the vaccine. Well, we got our own little scare with measles this year as Public Health in California in January reported on an outbreak associated with the Disney parks. This outbreak really captured the public's imagination, attention, and a very different dialogue about vaccination took hold. When we looked at the cases this year, most of them occurred in people who were unvaccinated or didn't know whether they were vaccinated. And when we looked at the cases that were unvaccinated, most were either people whose parents or themselves had philosophical or religious beliefs that caused them not to want to be vaccinated, or they were ineligible primarily because they were too young for routine vaccination. The babies getting measles, people who were ineligible for vaccine getting measles because of someone else's personal beliefs, really seemed to touch a nerve. And we've seen enormous attention to this issue in the media and in state legislatures since this period. CDC's Public Health Law Program has categorized the state-specific school vaccine exemption laws and posted this data on their website, which they hope you and the states will help us keep up to date. And we've also amassed the evidence base on state vaccine requirements and synthesized that on our website in immunizations, hoping that provision of this evidence base can help you at the front line of public health where these laws are passed or where these vaccine requirements are administered to know what the evidence base really is, what are the links between exemptions and coverage, between exemptions and outbreaks, and between exemptions and incidence of disease. And since the Disney outbreaks, we've actually seen a couple states pass new legislature. So Vermont has signed into law a bill removing vaccine exemptions, and Connecticut has at least passed this bill, and it may have been signed by this point. We know that California continues to discuss this, and I believe there'll be ongoing deliberation in that state. When you read the newspaper, you might get the impression that nobody is vaccinating their child, but it actually remains a social norm to vaccinate. Nearly everybody is vaccinating their kids. Most people have gotten most of the recommended vaccines. Last year, we tried to put together the tally that all that vaccination has had because it was the 20th anniversary of the Vaccines for Children program, that entitlement program that provides free vaccines to uninsured children, American Indians, Native Alaskans, to financially or socially vulnerable children. And we've just seen an extraordinary impact of vaccination of kids in America. We think 20 years of vaccinating children, even with the coverage that we've attained, has prevented over 300 million illnesses, 750,000 deaths, and saved $1.4 trillion. So looking backwards, or maybe looking sideways, it looks pretty good. I'd like to end with a few thoughts about where we go from here. I know I'm one of the dinosaurs in the room who's in the looking backwards section, but I thought I would dabble on where we might be if in 5 years you invite me to talk again at the conference. So where might we be? Well, I have a few hopes. I hope that we get better at speeding up availability of safe and effective vaccines. I think that the Meninge B example, the meningococcal A example, and the Ebola vaccine example show that when we really do try to connect public health need with vaccine development, we can do better. I hope that we can find some ways to make prevention more palatable. This is one idea. You might not like it. I also hope that we can find some ways to make prevention more accessible. Here's another idea. Would you like a shot of HPV with that latte? This is my moment where I have to tell you that we need to do better with HPV vaccination because cervical cancer and other cancers can be prevented. So I want to kind of return to the looking backward moment. This is the season of commencements, and most of the people in the room are a lot younger than me, so I wanted to end with a little bit of homilies for you. And I wanted to, we're far enough from the 2009 pandemic that I am allowed to show a picture of this animal, although I'm not allowed to say its name. So I want to leave you with my personal four H's. I hope that we can be humble. Infectious agents are the worthiest of adversaries. I hope that we can be happy. You've probably heard Dr. Bill Foege talk about the need to surround yourself with optimists. The pessimists might be right about what's going to happen, but the optimists are a lot more fun. I hope that we can aim high. We should think big. We should have big expectations and aspirations because when we work together across our jurisdictions, across health and other disciplines, we can have an enormous impact. And lastly, is that three? Yeah, okay, lastly. It's the getting older thing. Lastly, I hope that you'll continue to have heart. It's really rewarding to be in the room of all these epidemiologists working at the front line because what you do every single day in your states, in your meetings, in your communities is saving lives and making a huge difference. And I really thank you for all that you're doing. So thank you for having me back.